Welcome to the podcast series, Conservation in HD. I'm Natalie Sexton with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Human Dimensions Branch in Refuges, and this podcast series is part of a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service effort to put tools and resources into the hands of natural resource practitioners, and it's a collaboration with the Human Dimensions Branch in Refuges and the National Conservation Training Center Conservation Land Management Branch. And today, we're talking about effective communication in our conservation work. I'm joined today by Jessica Thompson, Assistant Professor of Environmental Communication Studies at Northern Michigan University. Welcome, Jess.
Well, hello, Natalie. Thank you so much for inviting me to be part of your series.
You've really been bringing the science to communication, and we've really been focusing a lot on the social sciences and how they can inform not only communication, but all of our conservation work. I know that communicating our conservation messages can really seem a bit daunting to folks. And today, Jess and I really want to provide you with some tips for improving communications. And when we're talking about communications, we're really talking about, you know, that could be with your internal team, it could be working with partners, connecting with visitors, it could be informal communications or formal communications. So, Jess, your teaching and research really focuses expressly on conservation communication and all the science behind that. And so where do we start?
Well, Natalie, the best place to start, whether you're working internally or externally, formally or informally, is with knowing your audience. And every once in a while, I get to teach public speaking, which is a hoot. Their students come in deathly afraid of having to stand up and give a speech. And by the end, you know, I've got to be witness to this massive transformation that they have. But the number one lesson, the thing I tell them on the first day and every day after, is know who you're talking to. Who's your audience? Who are they? What do they care about? What do they value? And so you're going to be effective as a speaker in all social contexts if you understand where your audience is coming from and what will resonate with them and their experience.
Yeah, knowing your audience seems like the perfect place to start. I know from my experience, sometimes you really have a good sense of who your audience is and other times not so much. So if you're not sure who your audience is and what they care about, how do we find more out about them?
Great question, Natalie. And there are actually lots of resources readily available. You can use existing information and public data, that much of which can be found with an easy Google search online. You could also do some pretty simple observations of your audience interacting with each other, interacting on site, maybe informal surveys, interviews, or focus groups where you just bring a subsection of your audience together and ask them some specific questions that relate to the messages that you want to convey. As far as public data that's available, there's really neat general population trend data, which you can find, as you discussed in your previous podcast, with U.S. Census data. The Nielsen ratings give a great summary of demographic information and media use, attitudes and values related to that, right down to the zip code. The Pew Research Center compiles social trend and demographic data by generation. So you want to know more about your target audience who happens to be millennials, or maybe you want to know more about retirees or the greatest generation. And so they have put together these very easy to read reports about target audiences. Maybe you're more concerned about climate change and what the American public knows and values when it comes to climate change information. And the Yale Climate Change Project, in partnership with George Mason University, has been conducting a national survey for several years. Since 2009, they've been polling a representative sample with attitudes and knowledge about climate change. And the interesting story about that is I've just wrapped up a major National Science Foundation project where we replicated some of the questions from the Six Americas research report, and we found that audiences at parks and refuges are considerably more concerned than the average American. So using data that's available, connecting it to your location will be even more valuable. You connecting it, triangulating with the visitor survey data, which you could, I'm sure, speak to. And I know it has a few questions about climate change in there as well, but you've got over 10,000 visitors who responded or completed that survey, correct?
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the points of that I think our research and yours both showed is that it's not really a one-size-fits-all message, that you really need to understand your audience and understand what might resonate with them. What we found is, you know, some people are less, you know, engaged on the topic, and some people are really engaged and really concerned. Overall, I think our visitors are much more concerned than the general public about the effects of climate change on wildlife and habitats, and they really want to hear from refuges about and learn more about how to mitigate those effects. But even in our refuge visitor population, there's different perspectives and different messages that might resonate. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that is exactly what our findings were too, that the audience wants to know more. We surveyed 800 park and refuge staff members and said, how concerned do you think your audience is about climate change? And they said less than 10% of our audience even cares. And then when we surveyed the visitors, over 4,000 visitors to both parks and refuges, it was over 80% said we are either very or extremely concerned. So it was so fascinating, the perception that some staff might have that, oh, our audience doesn't care. But then when we asked the audience members, we said we care and we want to hear about it here. We trust these people, we trust the staff. They're good messengers. But I love what you said about understanding the audience and what resonates with them. It reminds me, there's this example that I always keep in mind whenever I'm developing a campaign or working on a grant or as a consultant, and it's an oldie but goodie, and it's what I call the don't mess with Texas example. So in the 1980s, Texas had a serious roadside litter problem, and they were spending like $25 million a year cleaning up litter off the side of the roads. They had all these please don't litter and pitch in signs along the highways. But what they found, they hired this. Yeah, do you remember those signs?
Yeah. I was thinking driving from Ohio to North Carolina when I was a kid. I remember those pitch in signs.
Yeah, so they had these signs, and they actually ended up calling in this firm from Sacramento, the Institute for Applied Research. And they immediately said, you know what, those signs, please don't litter and pitch in, they preach to the choir. They preach to the people who wouldn't litter anyways. So what you need to do is identify the typical litter bug. Essentially, they spent time doing very informal observational research, watching people litter, then following up with them later to get some demographic information. And they found that the average litterer is aged 18 to 35, is male, drives a pickup, loves sports and country music. And they started to characterize their target audience. They're like, this is the person that we need to create signs for. This is the person we need to message to. And they named this sort of character Bubba. And they essentially brainstormed on, you know, would this make Bubba not litter? And they knew a fear-based approach wasn't going to work, and they needed to play on their identity. So Bubba's see themselves as good Texans, real Texans, and they created several public service announcements with real Texans, like George Foreman and C.B. Ray Vaughan, Willie Nelson, a couple Dallas Cowboy players, saying, don't mess with Texas. Well, within 1 year of launching that campaign, littering had declined 29%. And in market survey research 1 year later, they found that 73% of the Texans polled could recall this anti-litter message and recognized it. So it completely resonated and appealed to the audience's sense of identity. And that's all about framing the message in a way that makes sense for the audience to take action.
Oh, that's interesting. That's pretty powerful stuff. So are the words important that we use?
Oh, definitely. There's really interesting research on what terminology scientists use and what the public hears. One of my favorite articles by Richard Somerville and Susan Hassel, it was actually published in Physics Today a couple years ago, but they look at all of these words that scientists use. Like when it comes to climate science, THC means thermohaline circulation to scientists. That for audience members, they're like, that's the active ingredient in marijuana. And for much of the public, the word ecology, which again, scientists recognize as being an academic discipline. But for the public, they say, oh, ecology, that's environmentalism. And if you say, no, it's a scientific discipline, well, discipline is about keeping children in line rather than a field of study.
Well, I think that's a great example, Jess, about how the terms are and the words we use are really important and the associations that people make with those words. And I can't help thinking about stories when we're talking about the use of words. I'm wondering what thoughts you have about that.
Oh, I agree completely. We're storytelling animals. It's really what distinguishes our species. It reminds me of this very popular New York Times bestseller book that I use actually in my environmental campaigns course. It's called Made to Stick. And they give several lessons, but the final chapter is use stories, that stories provide people knowledge on how to act and inspiration to act and transition your audience from being an audience that's passive and receiving information to being engaged. So when we read a story or we listen to a story or tell a story to our audience, we want to blur that line between the protagonist and the audience themselves. We want to invite them in to simulate the experience. My favorite line from that book is that, you know, a story is powerful because it gives us this context, but it's powerful because in many ways it's a flight simulator that we put knowledge into a framework that's lifelike, that it's true, that's real, that resonates with our day-to-day experience. And the more you ask your audience to visualize and retrace step by step certain events, then you've asked them to mentally engage and invoke the same sort of modules of the brain that are evoked when they're doing real physical activity. So it's really great for developing conservation campaigns. I'm trying to get people to take specific actions or try new behaviors. But it also is very powerful when asking them to do or think something different than they might be accustomed to.
I really like the analogy of a flight simulator. That paints a great picture. Well, I know there's lots of folks listening that can tell a good story out there. And I think that a lot of us are good storytellers in our personal lives. I know my husband always says, don't let the truth get in the way of a good story. but I don't know that we always think about bringing that into our professional work. And so I think that there's a lot to be gained from bringing stories into our professional work as a very strategic communication tactic.
Yes, definitely. And I think the real challenge is to learn how to spot a good story. You don't need to invent the story, but to take an existing situation, a narrative, and accurately and sincerely relay it to your audience, that's going to be more powerful than any PowerPoint presentation ever was. It's going to bring them in at the emotional level, help them care about it. You're going to be more credible, and your message is going to be very concrete. People will understand it and remember it in that context because you've given them this flight simulator experience.
Yeah. So next time we find ourselves needing to be strategic with our communications, what are some key things that we really need to kind of keep front and center?
Well, definitely your audience should always be number one, front and center. What is it that you want them to walk away from this communication experience with? And how can you connect your message to what they already know, believe, think, and feel? And use some of the existing resources available. The Pew Center has great data. We've put all of our survey data on climatechangepartnership.org, the Audubon's Toolbox, Six Americas, several references that are free and available right now to help you start characterizing who you're talking to. And then pick the right words, frames, and stories to make it come alive, to give them a connection that then they tell their friends.
Well, thanks, Jess. That's a great wrap-up, and I feel like you've provided some really good insights into communicating our conservation messages with a few examples woven in there. And I'm wondering, if folks have questions, what's the best way to contact you?
I'd love to respond to any emails. My email address is Jessie, JESSITHO, at NMU, Northern Michigan University, .edu.
Okay, that's great. And if any of you listening are interested in being notified on future podcasts, if you're not already subscribed on iTunes, because you can do that, or if you have suggestions for future topics, please email me at human_dimensions@fws.gov. So this wraps up our fourth podcast in our series, and want to again thank you, Jess,